Good morning, friends. We are 6 weeks into the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is basically presenting the greatest sermon in the history of the world, okay? So, until today. No, I'm sorry. This is Jesus' manifesto for a whole new way to be human, and that's what we've been leaning into for these past several weeks, is what is Jesus showing us about our humanity? And Jesus, we've said, is establishing a whole new society called the kingdom of God. It's where God's will is done perfectly all the time. And Jesus is the one who is ushering in that kingdom. He is indeed the king. And he wants the future subjects of that kingdom, you and I, okay, to know what it means to really live, to really live. In our church, we want to be apprentices of this way of Jesus, this new way to be human. So we turn our ears to his teaching, and we find that what he presents is wildly, completely counterintuitive to any other way that we have been shown before. The standards of this new society are radically different than the ways that we have been handed down in our lives. Right? Don't murder. Okay, we got that. Check. But Jesus pushes us deeper. Don't even hate somebody in your heart and in your mind. Don't commit adultery. Okay, yeah, I think I got that one. Check. But Jesus dials deeper. Don't even lust in your heart and the body of a brother or sister. Wow. Jesus is calling us deeper. He's showing us how we can flourish as human beings. And he actually might have an idea what that could look like since Jesus created humanity in the first place. So he might be a good one to listen to. In case you hadn't noticed, we struggled to figure this out, okay? A week ago, 5,000 Hamas rockets rained down in Israel. And the world has watched on in horror as at the human atrocities that are taking place there. And then as Israel naturally responds saying, well, they started it, we're going to finish it, right? We'll see how that goes, right? Now, in our text today, Jesus says these words. You've heard it said, and that's been this like common thing we've heard over and over. It's like this rabbinical model. They use, this is what you've heard it said. Maybe you've heard it taught this way. This is how you've understood it. Let me help you understand it the way it's meant to be understood. Rabbis use this kind of thing all the time, and Jesus has done it now four times. He gets here now to the last two that we're going to look at today. You've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. As with all of the previous passages that we've been looking at over the past few weeks, Jesus is quoting the Old Testament, and specifically here, he's quoting Leviticus chapter 24, where it says, anyone who takes the life of a human being is to be put to death. Okay? Hold on to your seats, okay? Anyone who takes the life of someone's animal must make restitution, life for life. Anyone who injures their neighbor is to be injured in the same manner, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The one who has inflicted the injury must suffer the same injury. Welcome to church this morning. Glad you guys could be here. Everybody comfortable? Maybe not so much, right? Now, before we kind of write off the Old Testament as barbaric and recycle the bad theology that says the God of the Old Testament is a grump and the God of the New Testament, he's like our buddy. Right? No, let's remember how radical what's being said here is. This is actually beautiful. We think, oh, that sounds a little bit barbaric, but what's actually being presented here to the people of God so many generations before Jesus is actually the definition of equal justice. We want our God to be a just God. And it was designed not to perpetuate violence, but to stop violence in its tracks. We think, oh man, eye for an eye, that sounds kind of barbaric. But what's the human tendency? What's like the way that we actually tend to operate? It's not you take my eye, it's you take my, like, Jesus is saying here, the Old Testament is saying here, you take an eye, if someone takes your eye, you take their eye. That's not how we operate. We operate like this. You take my eye, I'll take both your eyes. Right? We always up the ante. Right? So you break my tooth, I break your neck, right? You fly a plane into my building, I'm going to invade your country. Oof, that one hits a little closer to home. Now, God comes along and he teaches his fledgling community called Israel, you're not to be like the other nations around you. Go before a judge, settle with equal justice. Then it's over. It's over. But of course that didn't work, did it? Didn't work very well. Because we're humans. Because we're broken people that don't stop the cycle of violence. We don't do this very well. Because aggression doesn't really stop, does it? It actually escalates. Eye for an eye is hard, but actually great in theory, but only if the violence completely ends with equal injuries, right? Everybody, like, shakes their hands at the end. It's like, okay, you know I took your eye, but you got my eye, so we're good now. Let's shake hands. Hey, it doesn't work like that, does it? Right? Two equal people missing their right eye, when does that ever happen? The other night I overheard my youngest son, Aiden. He came into the dining room and whispered in my wife Kathleen's ear, he said, "David farted on my head." Right? To which my wise wife half jokingly gave this advice, maybe apparently from the Old Testament, well, now you need to go fart on his head. All right? Now how many people think that that ended the conflict? Right? No, not even close. Not because it's not just, right? That would be the just response, would it not? But because we're sinners and it doesn't work. Conflict doesn't end, it escalates. So 10 minutes later, the complaint was, "David locked me in the closet." And not long after that, we hear the common refrain, "Aiden attacked me." You okay, buddy? Oh, look, he's like injured. He still feels like the injury. Oh, he's plotting his vengeance, okay. Somehow it feels cute and innocent when we talk about children who, like, we see this all the time. But this kind of worldview festers and it grows into something ugly as we become grown people, does it not? When I was 23 years old, I was called away from my desk at work to watch Islamic terrorists fly planes into the World Trade Center. Right? Knowing that my cousin TJ was somewhere up on the top floor. Okay? He was later confirmed dead, and what I wanted more than anything in my heart was justice, right? So when 3 months later our president declared war on Afghanistan, it didn't need to make sense to me, right? I just wanted to see violence done to the people who had done violence to us. That's the nature of the human heart. Jesus deeply understands this human heart. And he steps into a world where humanity isn't working the way it's supposed to. And he offers a new way. So the pattern actually changes a little bit here. In the previous four teachings, the previous four case studies that Jesus has given, it's, you've heard it said, now let's kind of go in deeper, let's push it deeper. Now he's like, you've heard it said this thing, but we're going to change it up a bit here. I'm going to offer you something better. I'm going to offer something better because this hasn't been working. The eye for an eye thing has not been working because you actually haven't been doing it. All right? So again, he's leaning into a new way to be human. You have heard it said, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, there's the pattern, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you in the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. So let's just break this down for a moment. So we can hear what Jesus is actually saying. Most of our English translations, in fact, almost all of them that I looked at, translate this word anthetomai as resist, okay? So we get this clear, but I think kind of unhelpful translation, do not resist an evil person. Now that's actually a challenge for us to accept in general, because that just sounds hard, but also because we don't even see Jesus doing that in the New Testament, okay? We know that Jesus resists evil people all throughout the Gospels, okay? New Testament and Greek scholar N.T. Wright, who I love, he helps us get at the meaning by translating the word and the phrase better this way, which is more accurate and more helpful. He doesn't say, don't resist an evil person. He says, don't use violence to resist evil. Right? Much better translation. It would be a mistake for us to hear Jesus' words and think we're just supposed to be passive, okay? He is not saying, he's not saying resist evil, okay, yes. Resist evil people, yes. Resist evil people with violence, no. That's what Jesus is leaning into, okay? It's good to resist evil people. It's good to resist evil. But he's saying not with violence, which is also a radical thing for all of us. Jesus is advocating for a new approach. He's seeking to break the chain of human violence by saying, when it's your turn, no. No, the cycle stops with me. And he's not in this alone, by the way. Later in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul picks up the same idea in Romans chapter 12. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, and we know that when there's more than one person involved, sometimes it doesn't completely depend on you. But if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Similarly, Jesus is saying, for my followers, violence cannot be an option. Get creative. Think of different options. And we got to love Jesus here because he's talking about this huge, big conceptual idea, you know, don't use violence to resist evil, but then he actually gets practical, right? He takes this seemingly impossible idea, don't use violence to resist evil, and he gets practical. I love it. So he gives four alternative options on how to resist evil, and make no mistake, this is resistance. It's just resistance in the way of Jesus, right? So he starts with the slap, okay? Oh, man, it's too bad David left, because I need like an example. Glenn, could you come? Glenn's like, I sat in the wrong seat this morning. Okay, all right. So he starts by saying, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, he's very specific here, turn to them the other cheek. Now, here's why that's important, okay? Most of us, you know, vast majority of people are right-handed. If you're slapping someone on the right cheek, this is Glenn's right cheek here, I'm not getting there like this. It's like this, okay? Which is a deeply shameful way. It's a degrading way to attack someone. Thank you so much. You can see, so it's one of these. It's one of these, all right? Thanks, guys. You just thought I was going to slap you, didn't you? All right. All right. And this almost seems crazy, but it's genius, okay? In a shamed-based culture, Jesus is illustrating the highest form of insult to which one might be expected to respond to the highest form of insult with a punch, with a fight, whatever the next step is. I promise you it's not de-escalating from there. But instead, Jesus encourages nonviolence and offering what? Offering the other cheek, right? So, like, and if you're offering the other cheek, just that person who is right-handed, you're setting yourself up for not a slap, but a, you're really getting hit, okay? Jesus is encouraging this way to possibly de-escalate, all right? It places the power back into the corner of the person who was hit in the first place, into the hand of the offended party. And yet they're not using it for violence. They're using it to say, here. Here. Now the next example is similar. If someone wants to sue you for your cloak, give them more. Give them more. All of a sudden, the power that they had over you is gone, which is devastating for the other party. Because what they wanted in the first place was not just that item, it's that power. But instead now of perpetuating conflict, you've taken control of that conflict. This is why we can't simply call this non-resistance. It is resistance. It's not passive, but it's also not violent. It's not aggressive. It's non-violent resistance. Jesus is creatively breaking us out of kind of the A or B, fight or flight mentality, and he's saying there can be an option C that resists and challenges at the same time. I love this third one. It's so famous because it's become a Western idiom, right? Go the extra mile. We maybe say that all the time. Probably almost everyone in here has said that, go the extra mile. And it says in verse 41, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Now, a little cultural context. In first century Roman Empire, a Roman soldier could legally command a conquered person to carry their gear or equipment with them 1 mile. So if a Roman soldier comes along and tells you to go 1 mile, that's a command from your empirical oppressor, all right? Now, likewise, they could ask you to give you what they needed, all right? They could come to your house and say, I need that, I'm gonna take that, all right? Now, at this point, the conquered person has a couple choices. They can A, violently resist and fight their oppressor, possibly even winning the fight, but certainly only aggravating the nature of the tension, right? Or they can B, passively just acquiesce and do what's been asked of them because, hey, this is the law and we're an oppressed people, I'm just gonna go along with it and move on with the brokenness that exists in this relationship of oppressor and oppressed, okay? But Jesus suggests this third radical, seemingly crazy option, go another mile with them. Give freely and willingly. It's a shame that this go the extra mile has become distilled into this common idiom, because at its heart, it's creative and it's provocative, even subversive in its ability to tear down the broken realities of oppressed and oppressor. Right? Jesus is not suggesting inaction. He's actually suggesting acting radically but without violence. Maybe even having a conversation with that person over the 2 miles. Wow. Again, it's not non-resistance. It's non-violent resistance. It's more than just what we don't do. Jesus pushes us further to what we do. And in a moment, we'll see when we get to the next section that we read this morning, soon we're gonna get to what we can do in just the most radical idea that Jesus ever had, called enemy love. But the bottom line is this: violence is not the way of Jesus. Repaying evil with evil is not the way of Jesus. Now, I know this makes some of us uncomfortable. Frankly, it makes me uncomfortable, okay? As Americans, we're all caught up in this complex system of military and militarism. Violence is just deep in the system of our country, and it's been here for a long time, okay? Some of us are in the military, maybe in this room. Most of us have loved ones who are in the military. Depending on your politics, most of us have been for some conflicts and against other conflicts, and then maybe reverse it, you know, depending on our politics, when the next one comes along. It almost doesn't make sense at all. We hear Jesus talk about nonviolence here, but didn't Israel, like in the Old Testament, didn't they go to battle with God? Like a whole bunch of times? Right? That seems kind of violent. And we look at the Old Testament, we're like, it almost seems like God is kind of violent. Like, what do we do with this? Now, we know that like hate and killing are bad. Jesus talked about that a few verses back. But isn't there this thing called like just war theory that I think I've heard about before? Here's the deal. I'm not going to dive into just war theory in this message, in case you were hoping for that. But here's what I do want us to know. Very smart, faithful Christians have disagreed about what this might mean. Okay, and about what nonviolent resistance might mean, and when, and how should we live it out. But let's at least start with some common ground that we have across our faith, and we can at least start here that faithful Christians through the centuries have agreed we must reject the binary fight or flight response. It's not just fight or be completely passive and roll over, okay? We don't need to be ruled by that binary, right? And Christians have agreed on this for centuries, since the first century, right? And at the very least, in these verses, we see Jesus pushing us forward to think more deeply about another way to fight, another way to be human. And we know we have unbelievable examples right in front of us. And in the past, just in this past century, right? We celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. as an example of non-violence against the violence of racism in our country. Now, we know we still have a long way to go, but his efforts to harness the teachings of Jesus as a reverend, as like this came out of his study of the Bible as a pastor of his community. Think about that. And he led then a movement of people to resist the evils of racism and violence that were present all around him. And he led a non-violent challenge that changed the lives of millions and millions of people and all of us in this room today. Right? How can peaceful, non-violent resistance win against lynching, high-powered fire hoses, vicious police dogs, imprisonment, and murder? And yet it won the day. It won the day. And of course, it still goes on today because there are people in this world and people are broken and evil and there's all kinds of broken stuff around. Nelson Mandela went into prison, just a violent radical, military radical who was trying to fight against apartheid with weapons, all right? He came out of prison, a follower of Jesus, who dismantled the system of apartheid in South Africa without ever firing a single bullet. Gandhi, well, not a Christian at all, because when he met Christians, so many Christians in South Africa when he lived there, he saw the racism, the brokenness. He said, I don't want any part of that, which should be, boy, that should just sit rest on us in a heavy way and say, what we do matters because people are watching, okay? But Gandhi was introduced to Jesus by some other Anabaptist Christians in South Africa, and he was utterly inspired by the teachings of Jesus, the same ones that we're talking about here today. And he went on to go back to his homeland in India and liberate India from British rule with zero violence. Oh, Pastor, like, well, what do we do? You know, what do we do about, like, Hitler, you know? And World War II is oftentimes held up as, like, this is a good example of, like, hey, sometimes you just got to go and fight and be violent, okay? I think that's actually a really good question. Like, we need to think about this stuff well. A counter question that we should at least be thoughtful about is, what if Christians in Germany and Austria, instead of just rolling over and fighting for Hitler, had actually said, no, we're not going to do that? How would the world be radically different today? All right? So there's lots of good questions that many of us are having, and this should be a safe place to talk about any of these questions. Like, what do we do about self-defense? Like, what if your life is at stake? What if there's an intruder in my house? What about serving in politics where we're like voting on stuff and we've got like our hands dirty and all this money that goes to seemingly violent things? What about serving on a police force as a Christian? Like, is there, like, can we do that? I think so, but how do we make sense of that? Well, what about serving in the military as a Christian? What do we do about those kinds of roles where violence might be a common reality? Sometimes we don't have clean, clear answers to these kinds of questions. But the church has to be a place where we can talk about these things. We can't shame each other from just because we're in one ideological camp or another. And that happens way too often. What we cannot do is ignore the fact that Jesus is actually calling us to something that is radically different than what we've been handed. In a world where violence and the cycle of violence rarely stops, we need to, at least in the church, have a safe place to process the teachings of Jesus together and have these kinds of conversations. Jesus doesn't let us stay in the cycle of violence. He radically says, you have to step out. You have to step out. You have to be creative and thoughtful about this. He urges us into something new and hard and transformative and beautiful. Now, if Jesus is hitting a nerve with you today, all right, I promise you He's hitting a nerve with the people who were listening to him in the first century. Right? Let's look at verse 43. And we move on to the next, and this is really the final in these six case studies that he looks at. Here's the final one, and really the most radical one, and I think most beautiful one of all. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, a couple things to note here. As has been the case with all these six of these case studies, Jesus is quoting a teaching that they've heard from the Old Testament. The phrase, love your neighbor, probably sounds familiar to most of us, not because of the Old Testament, but because of what Jesus says when he's talking to the teacher of the law. We just taught on this like 7 weeks ago. And he says, well, what's the greatest commandment? Well, the greatest commandment is to love God. And the second is like this, love your neighbor as yourself, okay? She's taking straight from Leviticus chapter 19, where it says, love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. But what does it not say back there in Leviticus? It does not say hate your enemy, okay? In fact, I checked, nowhere in the Old Testament can you find God saying hate your enemy. So you can find people saying that, even psalmists writing it in Psalms. What Jesus is probably quoting here is not anything in the Old Testament, but a common saying that had risen up by the time the first century came around. And it makes sense, given the long ongoing subjugation that these people had endured. Love your neighbors, hate your enemies. That makes sense. If you're a first century Jew, the life that you know is one of subjugation, burdensome taxation, and the occupation of a massive empire. There are old prophecies about a Messiah who will rescue them, and that's like a deep, sincere hope. They're actually looking like, could this be the Messiah? Is the Messiah coming? When will the Messiah come? They want the Messiah. And from time to time, a strong revolutionary would rise up and rally the people to fight, only then to be just crushed and countered by the might of an empire like the Romans. Now, you've come to the middle of Galilee as a first century Jew to stand on the side of a hill and listen to a man who some people are saying is the Messiah, a savior, a king. What's this guy going to say? Because I really want to know. Like, if he can heal the blind and he can cast out demons, surely, maybe, just maybe, he can destroy our enemies. Right? And what does he say? Much, perhaps, to their chagrin. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. They're like, yep, got that one. Thanks, Jesus. Yep. But I tell you, love your enemies, not hate your enemies. What? Really, this is what this Messiah has to say, nonviolence and enemy love? Now, let's break down that phrase quickly, love your enemy. First of all, the word enemy isn't just a person you don't like, okay? It's also not just a person that you're at war with. It's all of those things. It's like an all-encompassing word that we have here. This was a broad, sweeping term referring to anyone that you're in conflict with. And before we take communion, we're going to kind of pause and think about who are our enemies? Let's think about that now. Who are our enemies today? It's not the Romans, okay? And we struggle with that, don't we? Because we're like, yeah, Jesus, they're like, man, Jesus, that's powerful. Love your enemies. They should be loving those Romans. And we're like completely disconnected to it, right? Disconnected from it. But how, like, what if, like, maybe, you know, what does it look like to love our political enemies, right? What does it mean to love Donald Trump? Some of you are like, oh, like, give me a break. What does it mean to love AOC? Okay? Like, we think about our enemies in terms of political ideologies today. What does it mean to love those people on Twitter that you're just like, aching because I've got the perfect mean tweet back. Like, it's the perfect one. Wait until everybody sees it. What does it mean to love those people? Yeah. A few weeks ago, we were at a town meeting, and boy, you could feel the hate in that room. It was awful. But I was also moved by the fact that there were people there who were just there because they genuinely wanted to love and listen and care for one another. But there were other people who were not. What does it look like for us to love people who think differently than we do? When Jesus talks about enemy, he's talking about all these different things. This was a broad, sweeping term referring to anyone that you're in conflict with, as I said. But it's not just limited to Vladimir Putin. And it's not just limited to that coworker that you know is just, like, has it out for you. Jesus is talking in broad strokes here. Secondly, what does it mean to love your enemy? This is an important one because in our world, that word love just gets used for so many different things. Like, man, I love pumpkin spice, caramel, whatever at Dunkin'. And maybe you do. I don't know. I don't know what that is. But I hear it all the time. Like, man, I love it. I got to get more of that. All right. We equate love with all these different things. We equate love with the tolerance of people, with affirmation, with sex, with romance, good feelings that we have. All these different things get named love in our culture. Well, in Greek, there were a few words for love. And this word that's here, in particular, is a word that maybe it's like the one Greek word that some of us know. It's the word agape, all right? It's not a feeling. That's not what Jesus is talking about here. The Greek has another word for that, phileo. And sometimes we define agape love as unconditional love, but it's really even more than that. Literally, it's defined as the love of the will, okay? Willfully saying, I am for this person. Scott McKnight, who is a professor of mine, great, you know, scholar, I love him. He calls this kind of love, this agape love, a rugged commitment to be for another person's good. Okay? To love your enemy is not to tolerate them. Okay? Sometimes the most loving thing that you can do is call people out for what they're doing. Okay? But never with violence and never with hate. And that's become so difficult for us today. In fact, it's always been difficult. This kind of love is loving people toward their good, to live into the fullness of the image of God potential that they possess, that we all possess. And once again, Jesus gets practical on how we can do this seemingly impossible task. Jesus says, pray for them, all right? Some of you have heard me say this before. It's like such a beautiful, practical thing to do. One of the most fundamental ways to transform a relationship that you're in that's broken down and is experiencing hostility is to pray for the other person. Not like pray for them to get COVID, okay? Like, no, pray for their blessing. Pray for their good. I give this advice to married couples all the time. By the way, if you're married, you know that sometimes your spouse can feel very much like an enemy in your life. Pray for them. Pray for them. It will transform the way that your relationships function. It will reshape your heart, your tenderness towards those people. Pray for your enemies, Jesus is saying. It's small, it's simple, but it's radical. Because we don't pray for our enemies, do we? We bomb our enemies. We impose economic sanctions on our enemies. We mean tweet our enemies. Can you imagine a more radical teaching in the way of Jesus than love your enemies? I don't know that I can. Like, why in the world would we do this? Jesus answers that question for us. He says this. Why would we love our enemies? That you may be children of your Father in heaven. This is about actually becoming who we were made to be. Jesus is teaching us to be like God. This is what God is like, and he's your Father in heaven. His DNA is in you, so live into it. And Jesus gets very clear here. God causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Here's what that means. Jesus really couldn't be more clear to the people who were hearing him 2,000 years ago. Every time the sun comes up and every time the rain comes down, that is God loving on his enemies. Right? Wow. God's the ultimate enemy lover. And if you don't believe that, just look at the story of Jesus. Paul says in Romans chapter 5, while we were still enemies of Christ, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And here Jesus is saying, When we love our enemy, we become more like God. Wow. This is the deep, rich way that Jesus is calling us to be human. And it may feel uncomfortable. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? He says in verse 46. Jesus picks out two common enemies of the people that day, tax collectors, who were basically like turncoats. They were traitors who were taking money from their own people and giving it to the Romans. And then pagans, that would be like the Romans, non-Jews, anybody who doesn't believe the things that they believe, anybody who's like not on the right ideological, in like the right ideological circle that they drew around themselves. So super practical, simple advice. Jesus says, verse 47, greet them. Say hi. Like it'd be normal for you to do that with someone you love. Do that with your enemies. Whoa. Like, if you only love the people who are like you, then you're only perpetuating the tribalism that has wreaked havoc on the world for thousands of years. But we get to stop that. How amazing is that? All of that can be broken down and rebuilt into something beautiful, starting with a simple greeting, shalom. That was the greeting for, and still is to this day. For the people of Israel, for a Jewish person 2,000 years ago, shalom, it literally means peace to you. Jesus says, greet not just the people you love, but everybody, your enemies included. We see Jesus do this with tax collectors. We see him do it with Roman centurions. We see him do it with sinners, quote unquote sinners, all over the place, right? And we love this about Jesus. We think this is so cool about Jesus. We're like, Jesus is so radical. He's like so punk rock, whatever. He's like the coolest because he does this. But like, then we try to imagine doing it ourselves for those people that don't think like us. And we're like, no, not so much. This is what Jesus is calling us into. No, Jesus, you can't do that. You can't love those people. Like, what if we saw Jesus hanging out with Donald Trump and AOC today? What if we saw him hanging out with Derek Chauvin, the cop who killed George Floyd? Like, a lot of us would have a huge problem with that. Like, Jesus, you crossed the line there. And many of us would find that offensive. Jesus is calling us into that kind of offense. What if we saw Jesus sitting down to eat with members of Hamas? Jesus wouldn't be endorsing those things. Like, we don't have to jump to that crazy conclusion. That's what the Pharisees did. When they saw Jesus hanging out with tax collectors and prostitutes, they were like, he must be saying that's all good. Of course he's not. He's loving them. He's loving them. This is the radical love Jesus has, that our Heavenly Father has. Can we love like this? Like, for the past week, I've been trying to just sink my teeth into it. And it's hard. It's hard to figure out this, but sink my teeth into the history of the land of Palestine, which is, by the way, that's the name of that whole region there where Israel is and the Palestinian people is. And it's so sad. It's so devastating and oftentimes very confusing. We as Westerners, we really like to tie our eschatology into what's happening with Israel. And so we think things like, okay, if this is happening, that means the end is coming and we need to watch it. Like, we don't need to do all that. We just need to look over there and say, wow, there's brokenness there, and people are being hurt deeply, deeply. Lives are being shattered, torn apart, right? And that's just the surface level. At the surface level, it's not confusing at all. The clear division between two people groups who are enemies. And we look at a situation like that, and we probably ask ourselves, how could it even be possible for love to penetrate that kind of hate? And what I want to tell you is that testimonies abound, that it is possible and it is happening. Some of you know that I work closely with Covenant World Relief and Development in our denomination. And for years now, we've been supporting the work of a Christian organization called Musalaha. Right? That literally means in Arabic, it means reconciliation. And they're trying to do the work of reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis. Right. We know that there's deep enmity between those groups. It's obvious. We're seeing that magnified this week. But let's not forget that there are Christians who are Palestinians, and there are Christians who are Israelis. Like, we missed that a whole lot. Like in Israel alone, there are Messianic Jews, that's Jews who are Christians. There are Arab Christians. There are Arab Muslims. There are Jewish Israelis. There are deep ethnic and religious divisions that exist in all those spaces, just in Israel alone. Musalaha is an Arabic word, as I said, that means reconciliation. And what they do is they apply the teachings of Jesus that we've read here today to show people how to be at peace with one another. And one of the programs that they have is called Desert Encounter, and they do this several times throughout the year, where they take young people from different ethnic and faith backgrounds from Palestine and Israel, and they take them together out on camels, one Israeli on a camel and one Palestinian on a camel, like sharing a camel together, going out into the desert. Right? They take them out in the desert and they teach them the ways of peacemaking. It all starts with relationship. As simple as what Jesus was saying there. Like, don't not say hello to them. Greet them. Greet them the same way you would greet someone you love. And so before we end, I just want you to kind of catch a glimpse of what they do. All right?